Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I was really touched by the meeting this morning, and it felt so real. And, you know, sometimes more than others, you really get a sense people are speaking from the self, and I really felt it this morning. And, you know, a lot of people talked about community, and I thought, God, this really is great that people can talk about meaningful things like this. You know, in so many conferences, professional conferences, associations, and meetings, you get so bogged down in the nonsense and the bullshit and the politics and the finances. And so you do a wonderful job with this. Okay, as a way of framing what I want to do today and to help understand where yesterday's fit into this in terms of my agenda anyway, was I began the first night by doing an overview on denial, death issues, death anxiety. And last night I wanted to talk, yesterday, about the primacy of fields. And I hope those slides and the material really gave some sense of what this work is about. And it was more of a difficult presentation because you're trying to translate. I gave a talk about school violence about a month ago, and I felt I was doing simultaneous translation of four languages. And it was really tough because you shift in the paradigm so quickly. So if it seemed a little more labored, that's why. And I hope you didn't think, well, this is not about patterns, so what are we doing with this? I wanted to present the real foundation of what much of this work is about, from the fields and a priori patterns. Today, where we're going. Today, I feel, is really going to take us into the heart of the issue of denial and how it affects us every day. And I'm going to present some, what I feel, are very disturbing and emotional cases. And as I said in the opening on the first day, that any case that you hear is going to be a certain sort of a composite of cases. So if anything seems recognizable, you have probably good imagination. Why talk about denial and why death? And you know, if you talk about denial, you got to get into the whole field of death. There's a beautiful book. Not a beautiful book, a powerful book written by Robert Langs called Death Anxiety in Clinical Practice. Like a lot of Langs' works, it's cumbersome, overly pedantic at points, and it's brilliant. And he talks about, for him, the primacy of death anxiety, which drives the human psyche. And he says, for instance, how do we begin a life realizing that you're working towards your own demise every day, that you're moving towards death? Many people have talked, from Freud, from others, the Becker book. And again, if you haven't, if you buy just at least one book here, buy my book, I'd like that. But also buy Ernest Becker's book, The Denial of Death. He's a thoroughly brilliant person who has such an insight on human nature. And he's real. He's not verbose, he's not overly intellectual. It's just you sense he's one of these people that understands nature and how people function. And they talk about how we go about our daily life with the realization that we're dying. Now, I'm sure that's one-sided, and I'm not trying to paint a one-sided picture. Life is all about death, and we'll have more meetings like today where we talk about death issues and death of animals and all. We know there's a lot of beauty in life. And the way I often think about it, thanks, C, is that we have two sides to the shoulders. One side carries the beauty of life and art and grace, hope, aspirations, and the other side needs to carry the realization that it does end at some point. And I have found in my work as a clinician and as a consultant, as a father, as a spouse, as a friend, that the thing that seems to make life most difficult, and I said it the first night, are two pieces. One is destiny, the other piece is denial. And where I'm going with this denial piece is that it seems to be that the thing which causes us to compromise having a most meaningful life is denial mechanisms. For instance, you look at somebody's life and you say, I wonder why they're always sparring with people. You know, you got these people, so they're always sort of prickish, they're always kind of ding, they're always hitting somewhere. Okay, number one. You got people that have enough resources and they put themselves in the proverbial bare light bulb motel. You can go to a well-set table. I don't mean Ritz, that's not the point. But you can go someplace, you have a really beautiful meal, well-attended, or be with friends, and they live in a hovel somewhere. They go to these garbage places to eat and to live. What is it? people that have aspirations and real abilities. Maybe we have, but say somebody wants to talk about writing. I mean, I love to write. You know, people that want to dance, people that want to, I want to redo that room in my house. I want to have that family gathering we talked about. Let's pull everybody together and let's do it right. Something erodes it. And slowly but surely you find a lot of things happen, a lot of pragmatics of life. And we all have tons and tons of things we got to do every day to make life work, from bills to gardening to this and this. And then, well, maybe later I'll get to this. I'll get to the invitation to the family gathering. I'll get to the writing later in the day. I'll get to that fishing trip with my boy or with my grandchildren or whatever. I'll get there. But hey, what happens? Slowly but surely, time gets pissed away. What is that? Time gets pissed away. And you know, one of the things Jung said about human nature, he said, life is really not about sex. You guys are wound up today, aren't you? Bring back the dance tonight. I think we need it. Yeah, it's not just about sex. And that's a lot of his work with Freud. He said it's not about power and prestige, dealing with his work with Alfred Adler. He said it's about one major thing. It's about meaning making. And you can't say enough about this. And where I see this at work every day, whether my life or people I care, I love and work with and clinically whatever, is that meaning gets compromised. And the thing that causes the greatest level of depression in human nature is an unlived life. Now, this is stuff we know, but I'm telling you again, sort of from the trenches where I've been. And I see it every day. The thing that causes people the greatest level of this discomfort and depression and misery in life is when you know you got a gift and you got something you got to do with your life and you don't do it. I don't care what, and I tell you, honestly, I don't care what your thing is in life. If you care about, if your thing is you love to dance, or you like to make brochures, you like to run conferences, you're a psychiatrist, you want to do dog grooming, you want to raise flowers. I don't care what the hell it is. If that's in your soul and that seems to be your thing that fills you with so much life and energy, that's your issue. That's your destiny factor. That's the piece that has to be expressed. If you don't do it, your life, I'll talk street today, okay? Your life sucks. Basically, your life is basically going to suck if you don't do what has to be done. And you talk to people, you look at what they do, and you find that if a piece doesn't get expressed, it's a flattening. Whether you want to call it clinically anaclitic depression, a long-standing depression, which is what I find in many people, or something that seems more acute, it's just coming up because suddenly they realize what they want to do and they don't get to it. That's the issues in life, I find. So, you know, you should read all of your sociological texts, read all of your analytic texts, read all your spiritual texts and all that stuff, but it boils down to destiny and denial, in my opinion. You know, you find out what your destiny is and then look at how you deny it. Now, what is it, again, that causes us to piss away the time? You know you want to get to your study, you want to get to your garden, you want to do the work. And you know, it's palpable when you feel, when you go in your garden, whatever your thing is, and you do the work with the land, right? Or you sit in like my room with the oriental rugs, something happens to you in that room. Or you go to your study and you do your writing. And you know what? You're filled with an energy. Now, I'm not talking metaphysical stuff. If you want to bring in some people that have the machinery for this, you bring in Valerie Hunt, you bring in Beverly Rubik's work, you bring in some of these really phenomenal people that have the scientific side of this, they can prove what I'm talking about with images of studying electromagnetic fields, on and on and on. They can show what this is like. And what they actually done, read some of Valerie Hunt's work if you get a chance, a book called Infinite Minds. And she has been studying electromagnetic fields for many years, and she can show you what it's like when somebody is in the zone, so to speak. You know, ball players talk about being in the zone. Okay, we have a ball player right here, right? You know, you could throw it up from half court backwards and it goes in some nights. You're in the zone. And Bill Russell wrote a book recently. It talks all about being in the zone. Dancers know about being in the zone. Speakers know about being in the zone. That's, I think, a lot of where Mary's work, you know, with this gym work, talking about trying to articulate this zone in terms of mental states. Anyway, you get in a zone and something happens to you. You're enlivened. And what happens at that moment is you are filled with a piece of the self that is potentially overwhelming. Overwhelming in the sense that you can easily feel manic. Whether you're writing, you're doing your basketball, you're with your child, you're with your grandchild, you're with whatever the thing or the things are that are really, that you adore in life. And I can tell you that, and I've seen this across the board in people, what happens is the individual is so filled and they want to burst. You read your early your religious mystics, the sense of being on fire with devotion. The images I showed of Padre Pio and St. Francis yesterday. These people are on fire with the Spirit. Images of people exploding. the bodies explode because they're so hot with this stuff. A lot of this stuff feels like incredible sexual energy. I've heard people say that when they're in the midst of writing or in the midst of a project, they just want to sit down or lie down and masturbate or have sex because it feels like the same kind of energy. It is very similar. It's not about sex. It's about that zone you go to. And what I find is that repeatedly, people will avoid hitting that spot because it is so overwhelming to feel. Now, why is it overwhelming? It's overwhelming for a couple of reasons. One is, at that moment, life is really worth living. It's a good place, you know. It's a nice place to be. And you know what the next thought's going to be? I don't want to die. I don't want to die. And again, I've seen this across the board in cases, and in the life experience, and in literature. The greatest level of love and devotion, the greatest level of satisfaction and emotional openness to people and vulnerability is going to bring up the greatest level of death anxiety you ever will have faced. And I told you some of the little stories the opening night about when my son was born and we would just look at him. Somebody talked about doing an amnio. Who's that fellow here? Yeah. I remember when we did it with my son and I thought, somebody told me, and it never dawned on me, my denial, that one of the reasons people do amnios when we're older parents is some people want to make a decision whether you're going to let that fetus live or die. I never thought of that. Because some people say, well, if, parents that are over 38 or 35, whatever, if you have a Down syndrome child, they may say, well, we want to terminate the pregnancy. And I went into that not even thinking about it. And this friend, he opened my eyes. The other thing is with the amnio, you look at that, you say, that's your life. I kept that picture. You have the picture? They take pictures of the amnio, right? Yeah, and you said your child was kind of pushing away. I swear to God, when we did the amnio with Christopher, he was doing this. I swear, he was giving the finger to the amnio technician. He's like that today. He hates intrusions. So I don't enter his room too quickly anymore. But again, the thought you have to have as a parent looking at your child, at this new life is, oh my God, this is incredible. Oh my God, are they going to die? That's morbid. It ain't morbid. It's real. And Von Franz said it in the book, in the Pooh, and I think I said it the first night. She said, when one is fully involved in life, then you fully know death. You see, and it makes perfect sense, that one of the reasons we fully avoid life is to avoid death. You take that child and you withdraw from that kid. You know why? Well, life is busy and we have all these things. And my father did it to me. My mother avoided me. All this kind of thing. Well, excuse me. You avoid your child. You don't know what love is about. Who is it? Cat Stevens is that song? The cat's in the cradle. And then, isn't that a beautiful song? And then he says at the end, now I got time for my kid. Where's my kid? He wants the car. He's gone. It's that level that hits your heart that is just so profound. And I can't say enough about this. And again, I begin to see that The thing that really prevents us from this full participation in life is this death anxiety and denial. And some of the ways I see this, for instance, and this is one very powerful case I saw a number of them actually many years ago now. A woman came in one day and she was talking about feeling so displaced. She said, I don't know, I just feel like I have no home anymore. I have no life. I have no energy. I have no creativity. I feel like I've just been thrown out to the world with nothing that's mine anymore. And then she came up with this image and she said, I was driving down the road and I suddenly had this fantasy. And she said, I had this image or fantasy that God was pulling trees out by the roots and just throwing them away. And I was supervising with Robert Langs at the time. And I said, Dr. Langs, you know, what is this? He said, well, it's clear. She just had an abortion. I said, how'd you get there? And he said, look at the imagery. He said, the imagery is very much about things being taken out by their roots, things that are alive, biological structures, biological creations that are alive, whose life has been terminated, being pulled by the roots. Also, if you look at the imagery, suddenly being displaced, suddenly having a home taken away, suddenly having a piece of security taken, I feel pulled out of life. That learning experience was so profound for me on multiple, multiple levels. And what happened, I went back to the next session, she said, oh yeah, I just had my fifth abortion. And I watched her life, and I've subsequently watched the life of many people, and this goes across the board for men and women in my experience. I think it's more powerful for women because it's your body. And I think one of the greatest mysteries of life is that you can produce a child in your body. And Esther Harding made a comment in her book Psychic Energy, and also in the book, I think, Way of All Women. She said she felt abortion was really the prerogative of a woman. If you can create life, you have the right, which makes perfect sense. Where Langs was going with this, and that's why all this politics, it's so primitive and insane and destructive, and saying, do you have the right to take a life? It's crazed. Where Langs was going was that there is an unconscious, an objective, psychic response that we have to these experiences which transcend your religious background, your cultural background, and your family background. The other piece where I went with this, well, I'm trying to stay in sequence. The next piece is something I began trying to get at yesterday by showing the slides of the water, is that the psyche will represent its experiences by configurations and by behavior and by what's called derivatives. And tomorrow I'm going to speak in detail about derivative and unconscious communication. So in other words, when you hear the stories, I feel so displaced. God is taking trees out by the roots, throwing them away. These are unconscious derivative experiences and expressions of an event that has actually happened. Second level of this. Third level of this, which was a profound learning experience, was I looked at the life of the individuals that went through these experiences. And again, very similar for men. I would have men come in and would tell me stories of remembering being in Vietnam or watching the movies Apocalypse Now and seeing street people cut open and all that. And I said this is going to be a difficult presentation, so I'm sorry if it hits some personal notes of people. Many images of blood and violence and things being terminated and death kind of imagery. And I began to see that the life of these people seemed to revolve around premature terminations. Something that was begun and something that was stopped prematurely. I want to go back to the image I gave in the first night of the freeze frame moment. Somebody mentioned holographic today, and obviously I care very much about the holographic paradigm. You take a significant mode of expression in one's life. It's striking to me you begin many things and they stop prematurely. I've got 4 manuscripts. I've got 4 gardens. I got plans for what I'm going to do with the landscape. I got plans for the grandkids, what we're going to do, and the beach house and the vacation. It's striking. And this is the shift I was getting with the ontological approach. I'm moving away from initial interpretations. Just say what is. It's striking to me that there are so many projects that you begin and end. That you begin and that they end prematurely without coming to fruition. Freeze that moment. Put it on the screen. read that moment as expressing a contiguous line in the life process from beginning until end. And you begin to see that there are events, temporal events, not that cause it, Bill. I mean, we're talking about not that the events cause it, but they provide access into a field of abortings or miscarryings. And it becomes a leitmotif. It becomes a theme throughout one's life. So that so many projects, so that from that one event, seeming one event, I begin this and then I stop, and you see then it happens time and time again. Read it backwards and forwards. And remember I said yesterday too a little bit that this is why, Penelope, it's really great to have a series of four talks, because you really can hopefully begin to see the thread as the speaker builds and the audience, we work together to understand the thread here. That I said that you can really collapse the time function. You collapse the space-time function when you have the reality of patterns and fields. In that this is an event that's happening. It's not that it's just from the past, or it's not that it's your anticipation of the future. It's a pattern. It's a field that you're in that has a history and a future. So you don't have to say, well, is it this one event? Is it just because of the abortion? Is it because of the miscarriage? That's why you're doing that? No, it's because you're in a field. It's a field of which has a number of highly probable modes of expression. And where I go, like with those films yesterday, it's a very stable expression. In that what you have are all these things that are begun and they don't get finished. Well, we also began talking about how do you change some of these things? One of the big things about change is a piece of humility in admitting what we've done. Also, you're saying it's wrong and all that. It's not about that. This is where you got to get away from any kind of cultural sense of cultural influences and also a religious influence in a sense. Jung said the highest power is the self. That's the one you got to address. That's the one. If you can talk about kneeling before anything, you kneel before the self and ask, how does the self see this? So again, you begin to look at all these ways in life that we begin to stop a full participation. And that's what got me to this, okay? There's a lovely piece in this book, Denial. I mean, my book is just falling apart here, Denial of Death. And there's a piece from Freud. And Freud writes, this is on page 11 in the Becker book. It is not for us to confess that in our civilized attitude towards death, we are at once more living psychologically beyond our means and must reform and give truth its due. Would it not be better to give death the place in actuality and in our thoughts which properly belongs to it, and to yield a little more prominence to that unconscious attitude towards death, which we have hitherto so carefully suppressed? This hardly seems indeed a greater achievement, but rather a backward step. But it has the merit of taking somewhat more into the account the true state of affairs. And then they go on to say, this is from the introduction, the prospect of death wonderfully concentrates the mind. The main thesis of this book is that it does much more than that. The idea of death, the fear of it, haunts the human animal like nothing else. It is a mainspring of human activity. Activity designed largely to avoid the fatality of death, to overcome it by denying in some way that it is the final destiny for humanity. It's very powerful. Now, again, if you talk about denial, you have to bring death into the picture. And if you talk about death, we have to go back to concentration camps and the horrors that were done to people. And the question is, how does anybody deal with such horrendous situations? And death and the end of your own life being one of them in many ways. And a colleague of mine, his name is Glenn Morazzini, who practices up in Maine, he had a very interesting take on Lange's idea of death anxiety. Lange says that it's the actual death of the individual that is the most profound thing that we have to deal with. And Glenn said he doesn't think it's actual death. He thinks it's death of relationships. Which makes a lot of sense. I think it's more accurate, you see? The death of, you're never going to see, you know, the partner that you said that you love, you know, you're never going to see him again. I can't imagine the thought of never seeing your child again. Or never seeing another day. There was an episode on ER about a couple of years ago. And this street person was rushed in. They found him on the street, and he was obviously dying of, I forget what it was. And they said, well, we can give him an operation to help him out, but he really only has maybe, at best, a couple of days to live, even with the operation. And it was a black man doctor and a black man bag person. And this doctor is really wrestling with, well, we can give him a couple of days. And all the hospital staff, the business administration, said, what the hell are you trying to do? You're going to invest maybe $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in this surgery to give him another day or two? Or maybe a week at best? And they were pretty accurate in their diagnosis and prognosis here. And this black doctor went up to the guy and said, what do you want? He said, I want to see one more sunrise. It's all I want to see. And you really saw the wrestling in the heart of this young doctor. And he said, we're doing a surgery. And he spent the night in a room with the guy, and he was there when he woke up. The man woke up. He saw a sunrise. He said, thank you. And he dies. Now, it's a beautiful story, you know, on so many levels. And I really, to be honest, I can't imagine at this point dying. It's such a mystery to me and so filled with so many emotions, as I'm sure it is. I mean, a lot of older people in the audience, and you know, maybe we can talk a little bit later today about this. And again, I know this is very, very difficult stuff on many levels. And I'm going to talk in a few minutes about a case of a child that lost a mother to cancer. How do you live with the reality that you're never going to see your kid again? How do you live with the reality that the sunrise over the mountains, that you spend so many years to get to that, to the point of being retired so you can live in the mountains somewhere or live by the ocean and all that? Say, it's ending. And one of the other quotes says, there's two major pieces to life again. You know, here we develop, we become culture, and we educate and all this, and then we realize, well, eventually we're going to be just going to go in the ground, we're going to be burned up, and then our body's gone, and it's over. It's a tough dilemma. And again, the piece that I'm really fascinated with and why people have, you know, quoted my book in all those terms is the brutalness, and I mentioned that word a number of times, is because I do find that the denial processes are in many ways brutal to the people around them. Now, I want to try to go slowly here. Becker talks about what he calls vital lies, V-I-T-A-L, vital lies. And he says, without certain lies and certain illusions, we couldn't make it in life. Viktor Frankl talked about this in his books, Logotherapy, written how many years ago from experiences in the camps. Everyone develops a fantasy. Everyone develops hope. And look, it's a very, very tough